Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, and a happy Thanksgiving to you. Thanks for joining us on this Thanksgiving Day. We're awful happy to get to spend the time with you. And I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and I got two very fine guests with me. Chris Jeck, president of Catholic Answers. Thanks for being back for another hour.
Cy, thanks for having me on your show.
And Joe Heschmeyer, apologist extraordinaire, author extraordinaire, extraordinaire. Thanks for being back.
Midwesterner extraordinaire.
Midwesterner? He isn't a Midwesterner.
See, Joe, I'm using my Life is Grand in Kansas City mug.
I am very pleased to see that. When Chris was in town, I made sure he left with a pro-Kansas City piece of propaganda to bring to the office.
He did.
Do you have any like refrigerator magnets of Kansas City that people could put on their refrigerator saying that they visited?
I know just the person who would want one of those.
Do you know we have someone here who collects refrigerator magnets?
Only from places.
I did not know that.
Yeah, just from places that she's been.
Siobhan.
Who?
Siobhan
Cruz Kelly.
Oh, well, yeah. She hasn't been yet, so we need to have her come. I know exactly where to get them. There's literally a Made in Kansas City store a half a mile from me.
Well, if you would pick up one of those magnets, refrigerator magnets sometime, I'd like to give it to Siobhan for Christmas. I don't think she'll be listening
today.
I'm
saying I think she has to earn it.
Maybe she does.
No, I think she has.
I don't know what her standard is.
Isn't it the participation trophy thing I hear so much about? About how like the younger generations are spoiled for getting unmerited medals and refrigerator magnets?
Well, I don't know that this is that, Joe. I think this is more of, we know she likes refrigerator magnets, and in charity and love of our coworker, we'd like to give her a refrigerator magnet from Kansas
City. She may have her own rule that it's places she's visited.
I don't know. Maybe the refrigerator is divided up, you know, and there's the ones she's been to and the ones she hasn't been to. But she has a whole thing. Like, she will tell you about refrigerator magnets. Like, if they have texture. Is it better if they have texture or don't? I can't remember which thing she likes better.
I have to say 30 minutes
I like
into
you're revealing how much you paid attention to the details.
30
of
minutes into the
conversation.
Well, who can listen to this?
No, can I tell you who did listen to it?
Who?
It was J.D. Flynn.
All of our listeners.
Oh, J.D. Flynn.
No, it was when J.D. Flynn was here. He and Siobhan had about an hour-long conversation.
God bless J.D. Flynn. And Siobhan, too, but I mean,
we were saying thank you at the beginning of the first hour. Can I say thank you for Siobhan Cruz Kelly?
She's a wonderful
She is
person.
Executive assistant extraordinary.
She spells her name Siobhan. So I don't know why she does that. It's spelled Siobhan.
Yeah, it's Gaelic.
It's pronounced
Celtic.
Siobhan.
Yeah, Siobhan. You know what Siobhan means?
No.
Joan.
Siobhan means Joan?
Joan. Well, you have a great
question.
I love Siobhan of Arc.
Pronouncing Joan.
That makes perfect sense, right?
The French is Jeanne. Right.
Oh, so Jeanne.
The French is Jeanne. Right.
Yeah. So Siobhan. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I see it.
It's Joan. You have a devotion to Joan of Arc
don't you? Absolutely love Joan of Arc. I hope to make it into the Lord's kingdom, and I hope to meet her.
You will.
Sometime.
You will.
And
I feel confident for both.
I think I'm the complete opposite of Joan. Like, she has a tremendous physical courage. I have no physical courage at all. I'm the guy who freezes. Like, if they were like, you need to get the Dauphin back on the throne, I'd be like, you have the wrong guy. You have called the wrong guy.
I don't even know what a dolphin is.
Yeah. Right.
Well, she said something like
that. Yeah, now that she's in glory, can we call her Joan d'Arc de Triomphe?
Yes. Yeah, now, that's wordplay.
See,
that's
it was.
Not a pun. That's wordplay right there.
So Joan does say, I'm not certain how this is supposed to work because I've never ridden a horse or shot an arrow.
But she is obvious. She is a person of great natural and supernatural gifts.
Yes.
But among her natural gifts is physical courage. She's just not afraid. She's not afraid of it.
Well, and she –
I don't know if we want to assume all of our listeners know the story of Joan of Arc, because I think this is one of the most fascinating kind of proofs of the Catholic claim. That is a mere historical fact. You have to say a 14-year-old French girl who claimed to be guided by visions of God led France to a totally unexpected underdog defeat over the English.
Yeah, I think she's 17, by the way. Not to discredit her.
But fair enough.
She died at 19.
Okay, in that case, totally explicable.
Yeah, I don't know. 17, 19.
Oh, that makes perfect. Yeah, but the best part
of
Joan of Arc's story is
she said yes.
The transcripts survive. Well, not bad, but the part that's most exciting is that the transcripts of her trial survive. And so you can read the actual words that came out of this peasant
girl.
Not really a peasant. I mean, she's a her family's a landowning family, but not a wealthy owning family. But she's not a highly educated person, but she's a brilliant person. Like, she has a wonderful personality, and she has an absolutely sharp, astonishing mind. She's just a wonderful person.
And to that point about the story, or the story of the story, this is a thing that exists in the French imagination and in the French mythology and in French tradition for centuries. And then it's confirmed by this gentleman, Quicherat, who in the 19th century renders not just the trial documents, but the rehabilitation documents into what Mark Twain calls modern lucid French, or modern readable French, something like that. And then everyone finds out that everything that we have believed and known about Joan of Arc, in fact, is supported by
the single
best kind of primary source material given under oath.
Yeah, it's an absolutely, and Twain is a wonderful example of the power of Joan of Arc, because Twain is a curmudgeon. He is a sarcastic smart aleck.
And no fan of the church. No fan of the church.
Self-loathing Southerner.
Right. And,
yeah.
And he writes what is basically a devotional novel.
It is.
About Joan of Arc.
It is.
And claims it's his best work and his favorite work, even to his dying day. He never renounces his claim that the best book he wrote was Joan of Arc, and it's his favorite of all of his books.
He happens to be mistaken.
Can I suggest this would be a great solution to the perennial controversy about reading Mark Twain in class? Because, you know, Mark Twain uses language we would not use certainly today, even to highlight its offensiveness. In Huck Finn and in Tom Sawyer, but I bet he doesn't in his work on Joan of Arc.
No, that
he
doesn't
just
come
expose
up.
People to the brilliance of Mark Twain this way, and you know,
well,
no
I think Chris is right. The literary quality of Mark Twain in Huckleberry Finn.
Huckleberry Finn is the finest American novel.
It's higher than it is in Joan of Arc. Like the artist has not appreciated himself, as is often the case, correctly. But the fact that he fell in love with Joan of Arc, he clearly did fall in love with Joan of Arc.
Yes, he did.
Says something miraculous about Joan of Arc, and something really positive about Mark Twain. You know, that he saw what this was in encountering her. She's one of the greatest people in history. She's a magnificent person.
It's a totally unique story.
So let's add a little bit, because this wouldn't be Flannel Panel if we didn't point out failings in the church. And one of those failings was executing this saint. You know, that the ecclesiastical tribunal was an English bishop in a totally
he's a Frenchman, Joe. His name is Pierre Couchin.
Oh, sorry, a pro-English.
but he's
a
Norman.
Pro-English bishop.
Well, under English rule. And he was a Frenchman under English rule.
He was a sort
English,
of a Quisling.
English, I guess, something very different at this point in history. But anyway, so she's executed, but canonized. Her trial is condemned by the Pope as being unjust. She is canonized a saint. I know of two places in the Catechism where she's quoted, and both times are from her trial. And this, I think, also just to redouble, it's not just that this is sworn testimony, but this is sworn testimony that's recounted, as I understand it, from hostile sources. This was not originally some kind of hagiography of Joan of Arc, because the people recording these things wanted her dead. But nevertheless, she shines as a saint in the midst of this. So paragraph 2005 of the Catechism talks about one of the traps that was posed to her by her ecclesiastical judges.
Right.
Asked if she was in God's grace, she replied, "If I am not, may it please God to put me in it. If I am, may it please God to keep me there."
Yeah.
And that's such a brilliant kind of answer to these like trap questions. Paragraph 795.
Yeah, worthy of our Lord.
Yes, indeed. And so to have that kind of spirit-led testimony when your life is on the line, it really is. It speaks to her holiness.
She sounds like Jesus. So much of her testimony sounds like Jesus.
Yes.
This is a young woman surrounded by violent men, several of whom have attempted to rape her on repeated occasions. They've been cruel to the point of brutality towards her, and she speaks like Jesus when she speaks.
Yes.
To Joe's point, the thing I love about the rehabilitation is it's her mom who after she dies, it's her mom who says, you know, this needs to be looked at again. And then
and her mother's testimony at the trial that's held in Paris, which is under Vatican auspices, not under the French church, is absolutely heartbreaking.
It
she
is.
Loved Joan and she taught Joan very well. And she had her daughter taken from her unjustly. And it's beautiful testimony from a mother about her daughter.
But also to Joe's point, I think this shows the humility of the church, where the church says, look, this was a bad mistake that churchmen made, and yeah, we're going to correct it.
Yeah, the Vatican trial is a great testament to the church.
And I think it's something to keep in mind. I know there are people who they get annoyed, for instance, with Pope John Paul II for apologizing for so many prior injustices that he wasn't alive for and all of that. But I don't think anyone looks back on the rehabilitation of Joan of Arc and says, oh, the church should have just kept silent and pretended like a mistake wasn't made. Like, no, clearly the right thing to do was to acknowledge there had been some serious wrongdoing and to make whatever amends are possible.
Yeah.
But I do want to quote the other Joan of Arc line that's in the Catechism. She says about Jesus Christ and the church, I simply know they're just one thing and we shouldn't complicate the matter.
God bless her.
And
she always says things like that.
She could get a job at Catholic Answers.
She is just
she could replace me in a heartbeat. Her brevity is admirable.
Yeah, and it obviously comes from a place of faith and complete trust. And she lost her trust. She failed. I mean, we should mention that Joan failed, that she lied at her trial and pled guilty. And then because she was so afraid. But she was brutalized for months before she made that error. But then she was strengthened by St. Michael, St. Catherine, and St. Margaret. And certainly strengthened by the Lord himself. And she recanted the error that she had made in confessing to heresy. And she was, there's hope in that, too, in that all of us fail. All of us fall short. None of us is a superhero, nor does the Lord expect us to be a superhero. And so Joan's failure is also a testimony to her greatness in recovering from that failure, putting her trust in Jesus. And all she asked when they killed her was somebody hold the crucifix up in front of her face so she could see it as she died. It's hard to give enough praise to Joan of Arc.
Siobhan likes to say, Joan up.
Joan up.
Joan.
Yeah, like cowboy up.
Joan up. Yeah.
I don't know how we ended up talking about Joan of Arc. Honestly,
because of Siobhan.
We were talking
because
about
of Siobhan.
Siobhan.
Yeah.
Well, refrigerator
man.
She is a superb assistant. I'm so grateful for her.
But Joan has angels working for her now, where she's like, yeah, get them to talk about me and not even remember why they were talking about me. And it works. Yeah.
This is why we don't have to prepare before the show, because it always goes better when we just free flow.
If you end up talking about Joan of Arc, everything's better. It always works out better. You should have a devotion to Joan of Arc. Young men should love Joan of Arc and learn about her. Young women should admire her and model themselves after her. There's pretty much nothing that can go wrong by loving Joan of Arc. We'll take a break. We'll be right back with more Flannel Panel on Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
EWTN is the only radio station I play when I'm in my car. I try to listen to your show as much as I can. I listen at work.
I was riding around yesterday crying. I didn't know about your show. And I turned on EWTN on my radio. There it was about grieving. Maybe it was God-inspired.
My mom, she was the one that got me into EWTN 24/7.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I've been hiding this fact, but I'll share it now because I know that many people listen to Flannel Panel only because we're going to get to the NPR audio at some point. And I am thankful for National Public Radio because they've given us
so much material.
Some of the funniest things that we've gotten. What they do is outrageous and immoral, and it's at the taxpayers' expense to some degree. And we've really enjoyed exploiting their audio for purposes of merrymaking, but I don't have any. this time. So I apologize because I know many people are waiting for the NPR audio segment of Flannel Panel, but I just didn't get it together and do that. Sorry, guys.
I feel like three quarters of the audience just clicked off.
Yeah, why would I even listen if you're not going to?
Yeah, exactly. I'm glad you waited this long. Till,
if you're not going to play at least 75
minutes in.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but they did provide us with some outrageous and immoral radio this year. And
They will again.
They will. They will. They will again. And they probably did this time, too. I just didn't exploit it by finding it. So thanks, NPR, for all you do.
I was driving home from the office the other day, Cy, Joe, and I just did a little game. I said, I'm going to flip on NPR, and I'm gonna guess what it's going to be. I'm going to guess what the top. And I'm like, it's going to be something on transgender or abortion or climate change. I can't remember what – I had like four or five. It was climate change.
Oh, good for them. They toned it down.
Yeah.
Because climate change is the least outrageous of the things that they do. Although
I feel like if you've got those like four or five topics, you add like racial, really bad takes on race, you just have like five free spaces on your bingo board. Like you're going to get that every time.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing how utterly and completely National Public Radio sold out to the transgender ideology. They didn't.
The lie.
Absolutely, utterly lacking in even the basic journalistic curiosity, where you'd go, "Well, is that true?" Like, where you just ask basic questions, like, "Is that true?" or "Is that good for kids?" or, you know, "Should we be doing that?" They utterly sold out without even batting an eye.
Are you segueing?
Yeah, it's. No. I mean, not no. just NPR.
You'll know when I'm segueing.
Was actually the the that means a couple different things in this conversation. Anyway, the Associated Press was the one that I thought was particularly galling because they're supposed to be neutral, and yet their style guide now says to refer to people by their preferred sex, not just like gender. But if a man wants to say he's a woman, they have to just credulously say this is a woman, not this is a man who says he's a woman, not self-described woman, not, you know, you
no,
have to
not
just
even biological
like
man
you
who's presenting as a woman.
Right. Right. It's striking because there really are important senses in which biological sex matters.
Yeah.
And
right.
You would think even
like
someone
healthcare.
Who buys into the notion that there's a distinction between sex and gender, which is based on a misunderstanding. Nevertheless, like, if you buy into all of that, you should still at least be able to say, hey, if they find a body in the woods, can they say it's a young woman, or do they have to ask the family, how did this person identify, before they can report on that? Like, you know, there's an objective reality.
You just blew my mind with that example, Joe.
Yeah.
Like, my mind just blew. You blew out because that's the thing is, like, it's an utterly arbitrary thing. If you're dead and you're in the woods, then only biological categories apply. And if somebody says, well, shouldn't biological categories apply, say, in middle school or in high school sports or something? No, that's bigotry. That's utter bigotry for you to say that.
This is the thing that's so remarkable. I mean, if we're talking about, like, say, horses or dogs or anything, and we'd say, oh, yeah, there's males and females, and their life begins at conception, you know, when a hen lays an egg, you don't wait till the chick comes out of the egg to say that the chick's alive. It's alive right there in the egg the whole time. It's a separate being from the mother. These things are these basic scientific facts. Everybody knows. And yet when we get to humans, we suddenly forget them. And you'd have to be a religious zealot to think that humans are mammals and that they behave like mammals. I mean, it really is kind of stunning.
I
don't know. It's that basic denial of reality.
Right. And I do think that you're right to equate abortion here, because I think it was it's a skill that was practiced for 50 years in talking about babies in the womb, because they started to say things like, well, it's not a baby, it's a fetus. Well,
terminate a pregnancy.
Fetus and baby are the same thing. Like, whatever. I mean, every human being goes through a fetal stage. The point is it's a human young, you know, but so much practice at denying basic realities that has allowed us now to get to the point where, like, NPR, they think they're doing serious journal. Like, they think they're saying real things. They're not lying to us. They are utterly sold out for this. So, like, I don't believe that they're liars. I don't think that they're lying people. They're people who can't tell the truth, but they're not liars.
Well, what's particularly arresting is the large percentage of the population now who accept this rhetoric, as made manifest, and I think it was on your list of things, Cy. So here, I'm segueing for you.
Thank you for the segue. That's how good I am. I can get other people to do it for me.
In the state of California here, 65 to 35% on Prop 1. But
Prop 1 was the abortion one.
Yeah, yeah.
At any stage.
But Michigan as well, and then just a few months earlier in Joe's state of Kansas. So we're talking in Midwestern states where not just slight majorities, but large majorities voting in favor of the execution of the unborn.
But so, I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, I actually think that this is a hard question to answer because we want to find the one answer in particular that accounts for all of it. But I think there are different reasons different people come.
That's helpful because I was going to ask you about what are people doing when they're voting for abortion through all 9 months? Like, what is it that they conceive themselves to be doing morally? I can't understand it. Like, I can understand a person who says in the first 3 months or something. I can explain why they're wrong and why that's but I can understand it because I can say, well, they're thinking if it doesn't look like it's a human being, it's not a human being, and this doesn't look like a human being, so I'm going to say it's not a human being, or I'm going to split the, you know, I'm going to do the Solomonic thing and split the babies sort of thing. Ooh. But I don't understand the person who can say, I'm standing up for a woman's right to, and then include a child that's 9 months developed in the womb. Like, what? Or are they saying, well, I'm not really standing up for that. I'm standing up for the principle, and this is the only thing I've got to vote on.
Yeah, my feeling, Cy, is that, and I have been puzzling over this for the past couple of months, especially since the Kansas vote.
Yeah.
I think it's various groups. I mean, in the Venn diagram, they're going to have some things in common. But so you do have people who genuinely think, I don't think it's a lot of people, but they genuinely think that someone is going to benefit from this abortion. It may even be the baby, him or herself.
Oh, yeah. Some people do,
because they're going to be spared a life of poverty and misery. Or if not the baby, the mother is going to be spared the life of misery of being unable to feed this child or whatever. So I think that, I don't think that's a very big group, but I think there are people who pull the lever for that reason. I think a very large group are women who want to be able to fornicate without consequence. And I think an even larger group than that are men who want to be able to fornicate without consequence. And in fact, that may be the single largest group. We have abortion because men want it. Then there are people who are making money on it. It has to be a massive, massive industry, or people wouldn't spend so much money to promote it. And I think that we could go on and find. I want political power, so I'm going to say that I'm for abortion. I think it's difficult. I think it's easier to say there are diverse reasons or various reasons.
Yeah,
they're all wrong, and gravely wrong.
No, but understanding them is important.
We are great at self-deception, Cy.
Yeah, but in California, I found it so odd that two measures that would expand gambling went down to bitter defeat. I mean, just ridiculous margins of no, we don't want to expand gambling. And a measure that would allow abortion up to the moment of birth won by an equally ridiculous, like, what's the moral? Clearly these are moral calculations. So why does someone say, I have the right to tell someone else what they can do with their money, but I don't have the right to tell them, you know,
you can't kill someone.
You can't kill a baby.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating. The reason the Libertarian group or magazine did a video where they interviewed people who were saying they were pro bodily autonomy. They, you know, hands off my body, my choice, all that stuff. And they just asked them about a bunch of other bits of legislation, like, okay, hey, in New York, you now can't buy 20-ounce sodas. Are you okay with that? And they're like, yeah, that's fine. And they just like do one after another. And it turned out that My Body, My Choice only meant abortion. It did not mean take whatever untested drugs you want. It doesn't mean, you know, gamble if you want to. It doesn't mean, you know, have carbonated soda in 20 ounces or more. No, it just means abortion.
Yeah, because the big gulp, the big gulp, Joe. Oh, I'm sorry, Joe. The big gulp does not interfere with fornication without consequence. This is at the heart of it.
Yeah. I think that you're right. I mean, it does seem to me that there's a spreading problem of moral idiocy. And I don't mean that as an insult. I mean that as an... So I want to ask you about that. Why have we become a nation of moral idiots? We'll be right back with Joe and Chris on Thanksgiving Day. The recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade was a monumental victory for the pro-life movement. But the fight is far from over. With our new booklet, Why We're Pro-Life, we have produced the perfect tool to prepare you to have peaceful and convincing conversations to shed light on the truth about human life from conception to natural death. Catholic Answers is printing millions of copies of this booklet, and we plan simply to give them away. You can help us in two ways. First, by generously supporting this project. 25 cents prints one book. $2,500 prints 10,000, and so on. Second, by helping us distribute the booklet through your parish, your school, or the pro-life ministry you work with. Catholic Answers is going to blanket the country with Why We're Pro-Life, but only if you step up and help us. Thank you so much. For more information, visit whywearepro-life.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. I don't know how we started talking about National Public Radio and ended up talking about moral idiocy. How do you make that leap from National Public Radio to moral idiocy? That seems like a bridge too far.
I want to say something that I want to underscore something you said that our listeners need to think about, and it's this point. When people make voting decisions, they are making moral decisions. In fact, all decisions really are moral decisions. But these are moral decisions they're making, whether it's about the expansion of gambling or not, or the expansion of abortion. These are moral decisions.
But why we don't think that way?
I think this is the thing that's really the most effective thing the other side of these issues has done. Is mask their moral judgments as totally value neutral. That, you know, you've got moral judgments, you've got morality because you're religious, but me as a secular atheist, these are just objective facts. And so how could you possibly believe anything other than that? There was just a case, the World Cup is in Qatar, and they, aren't very pro-LGBTQ and the like.
By the way, to say nothing of Christian, they're anti-Christian.
True. Yes. Right. But they're not, they didn't no, but get no flack for that.
I think Joe's picking out this is like a protected group in our modern secular ideology.
Right. Yes.
The LGBTQ, and they hate them in Qatar.
So a guy wears a rainbow shirt to one of the soccer games. They don't let him in. And this becomes like a news story, as it was calculated to do. And a Qatari responds and says, I'm proud of what happened. I don't know when will the Westerners realize that their values aren't universal. There are other cultures with different values that should be equally respected. Let's not forget that the West is not the spokesperson for humanity. And, you know, it's possible, I think, to just say a pox on both their houses. that, you know, like, I'm not pro Qatar's human rights record or anything like that. But it is worth acknowledging that these Western post-Enlightenment values are not just the objective, rational values everyone comes to, that this is as much culturally indoctrinated as anything else. But they're so good at masking that, that we don't think about it. I always go back to the example that there's food and then there's ethnic food, because we don't think of, like, Americans or whites or anything even having an ethnicity, even having a culture. That's such a good kind of mask, because it makes it very hard to critique. And it's like that with values as well. There's values and then there's conservative values, or there's values and then there's religious values. There's, you know, like, these are just the objective right principles. So we can impose those. And this is, I think, one of the big deceptions, because a lot of people are deeply uncomfortable with abortion, but have been thoroughly indoctrinated with the idea they have to keep that to themselves. But if they're equally uncomfortable with gambling, they can legislate that.
Yeah.
The hinge of this is the idea that you have to believe in God to be pro-life. And that is a blatant lie. Plenty of pro-life atheists and plenty of pro-life Christians and other religious people who have secular reasons for being pro-life. That even if you buy into the idea that your values can't come from religion, which is a dumb thing to buy into, even if you're going to buy into that, the pro-life position stands on firm ground despite that. We have, in fact, a booklet, Why We're Pro-Life,
that
makes
you,
just non-religious arguments that, you know, like, so this is the critical deception, because plenty of people say, I'm not comfortable with this, but don't feel like they have the ability to act on that belief because they've been told they don't by a culture that masks its kind of oppressiveness.
Well, it's the myth of progress, I think, at the root there, Joe, because the idea is that the West is making progress and other people will catch up in time. And what we just need to do is keep, you know, pushing and they'll catch up. The idea that they would say no and that no might be firm and might last is shocking to people. I would like to say I appreciated the Qatari man saying that the West is not the spokesperson for humanity. I think that that is exactly right. And someone needs to tell him, though, that there is a spokesperson for humanity.
Yes, that's right.
And that spokesperson is Jesus Christ. And that's who speaks for us. And what he says is humane. And what he says is not humane is not humane. Like, that's the standard.
Yeah, I think it's totally possible to say the abominable things that the Qatari government does to people who engage in homosexual activities. That's not something we support as Christians. Without then saying, let's wave the rainbow flag and bring it to the World Cup.
Well, in fact, is that not what the American soccer team is going to do now? They're going to wear these flags on their
uniform. Oh, well, good for them. Well, good for those, because that'll cost them nothing, but it'll.
Well, they could put a cross on their shoulder well. I mean, there are Christians in jail, and I'm sorry, I thought it was Qatar. It's Qatar.
It's actually pronounced gutter.
It's an Arabic word. Qatar is closer, but neither of these are very good pronunciations.
No, there's right.
I still say Peking.
Really? For Beijing?
No, I'm being sarcastic a little.
You can order Peking duck, right?
That's right.
It's still Peking duck. Yeah, I don't think you say Beijing duck.
Yeah. Although. Yeah, you don't say Mumbai sapphire.
What kind of sapphire?
Bombay. It's still Bombay.
Oh. I don't even know what that is. So what is Bombay Sapphire? Is that
gin?
It's a kind of gin.
Oh, sorry. I didn't know. I'm sorry. I didn't know. If it was about a Happy Meal, I would know. All right? If it's different kinds of Happy Meals, then I would know.
Lunchables and Happy Meals are the last two things I've heard about you eating.
Probably those are the last two things I ate, too, with the donut in between. I want to move on to the marriage thing. Yeah. Can I segue to that? Because
well, this is why we have abortion.
Actually, could I say something real quick? Sorry. I wanted to throw two things out, if I may. One, and we talked about this during the commercial, but I wanted to bring this up. There is a study that looks at the linkage between pornography viewing and abortion. It's called U.S. Adults Pornography Viewing and Support for Abortion, a three-wave panel study, and it was published in Health Communication. And it found that the more you look at pornography, the more likely you are to support abortion. So this underscores the idea that this really is a sin that is linked to sexual sins, that, What it reminded me of is something Pope John Paul II said in Reconciliation and Penance, which is one of his apostolic exhortations. He said, there is no sin, not even the most intimate and secret one, the most strictly individual one, that exclusively concerns the person committing it. Right. With greater or lesser violence, with greater or lesser harm, every sin has repercussions on the entire ecclesial body and the whole human family.
Amen.
That if you take the idea of the body of Christ seriously, and you take the idea that when one part of the body rejoices, we all rejoice. When one part suffers, we all suffer. This means that even your most private sin has these ripple effects. And I think that's something worth really grappling with, especially when you think about, because if you're thinking about things that are considered intimate, secret sins, individual sins, I think pornography would be near the top of the list for a lot of people. But there's a pretty direct line between pornography and fornication and abortion. And you just get mass death
Divorce. Very
quickly. Yeah. So all of this whole breakdown, even in interpersonal relationships, and this is, I think, a good segue to talk about the breakdown in marriage. All of these things are interconnected in this web where every sin has these repercussions on the entire human family.
Thank you, Joe. I want to move on to this other thing, though, because I'm quite startled by it. And it's when you see it in chart form, it's amazing. But let me tell you, let me set a little context for you. We're going to talk about marriage in the United States. And marriage rates throughout the 20th century in the United States were relatively stable, although they're higher in the middle of the century than at the beginning or the end of the century. And we're all familiar with the baby boom and all that. So there's also a marriage boom that comes after the Second World War. The lowest marriage rate in the entire 20th century happened in 1932, which seems to me related to the onset of the Great Depression. But I don't know that, but it seems correlated. And that was the only time in the entire 20th century, was 1932, that the marriage rate dropped below 8 marriages per 1,000 people. So that's the way we measure the rate. How many marriages per 1,000 people? The 1 year in the entire 20th century, it dropped below 8. Since 1990 now, it's gone from, it was 9.8 in 1990, which is about the middle of the 20th century rate. So 1990, we're about in the middle of the 20th century, actually had recovered from a low rate a little bit in the decade and a half before. So 1990, we're at 9.8. Since 1990, we are on a downward trend so that by the year 2000, we're at 8.2. Now, remember, there's only 1 year in the entire 20th century that we're below 8. We're at 8.2 in the year 2000. 2001 at 8.2. Then by 2003, we're at 7.7, which is the lowest that had ever been measured to that point, and we never go above 8 again for the next 20 years. We never go above 8 again. So that is every year now, we are far below the lowest year of the 20th century. But what happens is you see a little recovery. Around 2009, it settles at 6.8, which is the lowest it's ever been, in 09, 6.8, and then 6.8 and 10, 6.8 and 11, 6.8 and 12. So we stabilize. See, we're not falling anymore. Then after the year 2015, after the year 2016, where it actually goes up to 7, a massive fall off until we are at 5.1 in the COVID year of 2020. 5.1. It does seem like there is some relationship between the Obergefell decision in 2015 and that fall off, but who knows? It just seems that way. I mean, if you look at, well, what happened to marriage? Well, we had the Obergefell decision legalizing gay marriage in 2015. We had one good year after that, and then it fell off a cliff. And it fell off a cliff before the pandemic. We were reaching a new low every year before the pandemic, and then it utterly crashed in the pandemic year. So that's what we want to talk about, is what is going on with marriage. We are now at a marriage rate that is one half of the average rate in the 20th century. Only half as many people are getting married today as did throughout the entire 20th century.
And that, by the way, is all marriages. That's not Catholic marriages. That's
no,
not
it's all marriages in the population.
Oh, actually, going to Vegas.
I was going to say it the other way. I was going to say, by the way, Catholics aren't immune from these statistics.
No, right.
Our marriage rate has dropped just as precipitously.
Right.
More precipitously, I believe.
I think so.
Maybe starting from a slightly higher point, though. But we're – so in other words, we're not getting married. And we know from statistics we read in the Pillar Catholic and all the,
yep.
that we're not baptizing our children. We have fewer
no funerals.
First communions, fewer funerals, all that. Is going on. I'm going to leave you to meditate on that for a minute, and we'll get the reaction and maybe some hope for how do we repair this from Chris and Joe right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Hosting Women Made New has helped me deepen my own faith, and I look forward to every weekend having those in-depth discussions with my guests. It's been such a blessing being a part of the EWTN family and carry on the mission that Mother Angelica started.
Women Made New, Saturday noon Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. So what to make of this? A rapid decline in the marriage rate since 1990, going from 10 all the way down to the year, 30 years later in the year 2020, down to 5.1. Every year we're setting a new record, but a crash in marriages after 2016. I'm relating that to the Obergefell decision, but that is utterly self-serving, I guess, in a certain sense that I don't think that that was a good decision, so maybe I'm predisposed to think of that as discouraging marriage. But in a certain sense, you'd think, well, with the Obergefell decision, wouldn't you think marriages would go up? Because now we got now we're counting gay marriages as marriages as well. But no, they
more
crashed.
More people can get married.
The total just utterly crashed over the last four or 5 years. What do you both make of it? What do you want to say about it?
It's really dire. I mean, one of the things that I'm struck by is as we move away from Christianity as a culture, one of the last things to go are birth, death, and marriage kind of connections. You know, like if your parents are religious and you're kind of nominally religious, the times you show up are baptisms, weddings, and funerals. And then if your parents are doing that, well, you're probably not going to show up for anything. And I think we're starting to see that.
Yeah,
that as you've got people right now who have never intimately seen a functional marriage, meaning you've got adults now whose parents were divorced and whose grandparents were all divorced and who have no recollection of a healthy, functional marriage in any form.
So very well. And, so we're in the third generation of the sexual revolution, in other words. And the third generation
exactly.
And is I think reaping it's, the
and not just sexual revolution, but no-fault divorce. And so all of these prior situations, and I don't want to glamorize the past. I mean, you had some horrible marriages in the past, of course. There's a reason there was such a push for divorce. But nevertheless, you also had resilient marriages where people actually fought it out. And the things that seemed really dire in, you know, year five of marriage were distant memories by year 10. And with no-fault divorce, a lot of times you just take the off-ramp when the going really gets tough. And so we don't see marital resilience. You don't see what to do when a problem arises, because as a child, you're not seeing that in your parents. You're seeing when the going gets tough, we leave.
So why get married?
I think divorce is actually now something in the past. We've gone from a divorce culture to just a non-marriage culture.
Yeah,
we're just not having marriages to begin with. Jackie and I were married 31 years ago. Most households were married couple households. So more than half, well more than half. And I think it's about 12 years ago that we see this demographic shift where most households are not married couple households, and it's unlikely to return. Joe says it's dire, and I think that needs to be underscored, because people will say, oh, there's been times in history when things have been bad. You can't have a civilization without marriage. You can't. You can actually have a civilization without the incarnation. I mean, historically, this was done. They did it in Greece. They did it in Rome. But what you have to have is marriage. I mean, it is a universal, natural human institution, of course, elevated to a sacrament by Jesus Christ. And now, since the incarnation, you know, it takes on that quality. But it's necessary. Marriage is necessary to civilization. So when we see what we were talking about in the previous segment, people just being, as you say, moral idiots, this is a consequence of a society in which there is no marriage, because marriage is the natural incubator, if you will, for, you know, moral common sense, yeah, for example. So without marriage, you don't have civilization. I don't see this trend reversing. It's reversing, or it never happened in certain small communities and parts of the country, perhaps, or where you have, you know, Catholic homeschooling families or something like this. But as you observed in the break, Cy, that uniquely American sect, the Mormons, which used to be sort of a religion that worshipped marriage and family. Now they're saying, we're okay with gay marriage,
at least in a
certain terms of
sense.
Legislation.
Yeah,
yeah,
in a certain sense. That, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that, I mean,
so
that's the first.
They're accommodating
step. The first,
themselves.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, the Mormons reversing themselves on marriage because of U.S. law is not a new story.
No, every revelation they've had was a consequence of.
Declaration 1 at the back of Doctrines and Covenants is them basically saying, now that the U.S. government has outlawed polygamy, the angel says we don't have to have plural marriage anymore.
Well, and then the angel,
which is a fascinating way the angels under U.S. jurisdiction.
And then following the Civil Rights Act of 1964, they had a revelation about whether or not dark skin was.
Yeah,
a
that's
curse.
Official declaration number two.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The two special declarations they get are these like pretty brazen.
Well, I said it's an American religion.
U.S. law.
But well, without marriage, yeah. You don't have civilization. You don't.
So just to maybe, can I underscore the direness even more? So I know you were about to say something. I just want to give one stat to really underscore this, because you mentioned the percentage of households that were married when you got married. But if you look at 1970, the census data says that 40% of U.S. households were married couples with children.
Yeah.
So you've got both those things together. You've got mom and dad and kids, 40% of households. Today, as of 2021, 17.8%.
Yeah.
It's less than half. You can live in a community where nobody on your block is a married couple with kids.
And by the way,
that is such a bizarre society.
And then if we say they are the children of the two parents, they are the biological children of the two parents living in that home. In other words, an intact marriage that right. You know, hasn't been a remarriage, that shrinks from, I don't know, 17 to what, maybe 12% or something like that. So, yeah. This is a very, very bad situation. It's very bad.
Yeah.
Moynihan was – oh, I'm sorry. You take it, Cy.
Well, no. I just wanted to say I think there is a myth that still persists that the world after Christianity, the post-Christian world, is a liberated world. And there's not enough serious consideration of the possibility by secular people – that might not be true. That might, like, you almost want to say, okay, I get it. You don't want to accept Jesus Christ, you know, at this moment. But consider this. It might not be better for the world to move on from Christianity. The evidence is not piling up that this is a good move. But I still think there's too much of a sense of denial to even be able to have that conversation where you go, Is this a smart move for humanity? It doesn't seem to be.
Cy, can I tell you that we've known the answer to this question now for several generations before I came to Catholic Answers. I worked for a little Midwestern think tank called the Rockford Institute. We had a publication called The Family in America. And all we did once a month with this publication was go through the social science journals. And by the way, mostly edited by leftists and peer-reviewed by leftists. And they attached every single human pathology that you can come up with. Teen suicide, teen drug use, poor performance in school, depression, whatever it is, all of these things were associated with marital breakdown. All of them were. All of them were.
Yeah. So
we've known this for a very, very long time, and yet we still these people in the social sciences, they're still writing grants to say, boy, if we could just figure out, all we need to do is just have, you know, figure a way to have more quality time, or if we could just figure a way to make divorce work, or
if every kid could have high speed internet, that's then, right. Then all these outcomes would be equal.
Or really high quality daycare. Yeah. Or whatever.
But that's the thing is that we're going to see another election here. You know, we'd have these 2-year elections now for president of the United States. The state of marriage is not going to be an issue. It's probably the most important thing that we need to talk about.
Yes.
No Republican, no Democrat, no Green Party, nobody is going to make this an election issue. Nobody wants to talk about it.
Well, and partly it's very hard to know what to do with it as an election issue. Like, how do you solve this in a political kind of way? And in some senses, it shows the limitations of the political process. Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska has a book where he argues basically that this is what the real problem is. This is with marriage. But he says this is all upstream from politics. That if you want to know why politics is so dysfunctional, sure, because culture is so dysfunctional.
Yes.
And in truth, I think it's a little more of a two-way street than that. But if we could get marriage fixed, a lot of these problems would be solved as well. I think this is one of the things which I remember tying this into the abortion conversation from earlier. While Roe v. Wade was on the books, it was easy to say, look at these activist judges. These 7 people are the problem. And then once Roe v. Wade was overturned, it became clear, oh, no, the rot is much deeper than that. You know, there are a lot of people who were totally happy. I mean, because this is the thing that's really remarkable. It's not just people who support abortion, people who will vote for the ability not to legislatively be able to regulate abortion, people who will actually vote their rights away to regulate abortion. That's what a lot of these, you know, in California, in other places, this is what the fight was. Even in Kansas, the entire constitutional amendment wasn't to outlaw abortion. It was to put it back in the legislative sphere. And 60% of Kansans said, we'd rather not have those rights. It shows that this is really where the problem is. And it is, I think, upstream of politics, that unless we solve those kind of issues, we're going to be facing a really dire uphill battle.
It's well
on
upstream.
The legislative.
It is well upstream of politics. By the time a question of a natural human truth, what is marriage or what is a baby, by the time things like that actually appear on a ballot, then the question's been lost. It's been lost. It, yes. It's lost. It's lost at dinner tables, at dinner table conversations in American households. It's lost in so-called women's magazines. It's lost in the jolly sitcoms that, you know, portrayed the alternate lifestyles as, you know, jolly. And this cultural battle has been lost for 3 generations. And the birth control pill, of course, which, you know, kicks it off.
I have to say, one positive sign I do see in the Catholic community is there is a kind of subculture of Catholic young people who are very interested in marriage and children, who want to do those traditional things. And I'm not talking about traditional liturgy. I'm talking about like things that human beings have always wanted. They've learned, well, that's probably where my heart should be. And they're looking for marriage and family. And I see them coming out of institutions like, you know, Thomas Aquinas College up the road from us, but also, you know, learning it from just reading Pope John Paul, you know, or from listening to Matt Frad or whatnot.
New Polity Institute, I recommend that.
Yes.
Yeah. These people are talking about this problem.
You know, so this is something Anthony Eslin says. If we want to, I know we're about to end. On a happy note, he said, the devil promises you steak but feeds you cardboard.
Yeah.
And as people come to see that, there's a real opportunity to help people to see the way they're dissatisfied with these choices and point to a better and happier way of existing.
All right. Well, that does it. Chris Check, thank you. I'm thankful for you.
God bless you, sir. I am thankful for both of you.
And Joe Heschmeyer, Chris and I are both thankful for you.
Oh, thanks. I'm thankful you guys.
I'm thankful for the people who produce this show.
Especially Darren.
Yes.
But also a little bit Edgar. And then who's on video right now? Oh, a lot for Zach.
Oh,
a whole
Zach.
Lot. For
Zach's Zach, getting so. Married. Zach
Yay,
is getting married.
Zach's doing the right thing. Good job.
He's solving Zach. The problem.
He's
one marriage at a time.
One marriage at a time.
Amen.
Happy Thanksgiving. We'll see you next time. God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.